Welcome back to The Shift of Land. I'm Sarah Parker. The Shift of Land is a 13-part series which explores the connection between land and culture and agriculture in New Mexico. We also ask the question, what does it mean to be New Mexican? In this program, we will be listening to the voices of Native peoples whose ancestors first cultivated and developed a relationship with the land that we now call New Mexico. They allowed the land to affect and shape their cultures. We will try to understand how. Before the European systems came in, the people's relationship to the land was more complicated than just agricultural and urban areas. People relied on all that the land gave, like the buffalo, wild rice in the north, different nuts and berries, and different grasses to make flowers. Different nations also cultivated food like corn and squash. In the New Mexico area, the Pueblos are most known for this. Other lands that were hotter, drier, less hospitable to people were only passed through at different times of the year. All over the state, buffalo was a main staple.
You know, at one point in our history here at Picaries Pueblo, they were hunted for food, and they ranged up as close as the Mora Valley, just about 30 miles east of here. They were monitored, they were watched, and of course, you know, it had to be a group of strong young people that knew how to process that animal out there in the field. You know, it wasn't something that was killed and then brought back. It all had to be processed there where all that was done. So I'm sure it took a lot of effort to do that. You know, there was a lot of trading that went on with different tribes, different plains tribes that came in over to this area, or Picaries and other Pueblos within this area. They went out to the plains too, and I'm sure they did the same thing.
Danny Sam is in charge of the bison program at Picaries Pueblo.
That's where that culture lies. We still practice an annual buffalo dance here, as most Pueblos do. There's that cultural significance. You know, it's to honor that animal. Pray for more of them to be available. At one time, it was an economic source. We traded goods, different products that were made from that animal, meat, hides, even tools, utensils that were made from them. The bison do impact the land different. For one thing, the bison themselves are hardier animals. They take less care. I've raised cattle before, and I prefer raising bison over cattle. I have more trouble with the cattle than I do with the bison. So the bison will eat a lot of the different plants out there, and they're in turn, it's passed on to us. They know a lot of the plants that they like to eat, and it's not always just grass, you know, and there again, it goes back to the way it used to be, you know, how the prairies were. You know, people think that out on the plains that the prairies were nothing but just pure grass growing, and, you know, that's not the case. You know, there were a lot of other indigenous plants that were there that were part of the whole ecosystem. And the bison were part of that ecosystem. The wolves were part of that ecosystem. It all worked together until the farmers came in and started ripping up the land and planting all the exotics out there, you know. And now that's what people have in their mind as far as what the prairies should look like. And it's the same up here in the mountains, you know. We have these big, huge mountain meadows. It's a mixture of all these different plants. So a lot of them are indigenous, and there's a lot of plant life here that was introduced that are exotic plants that now a lot of states are trying to get rid of. They're having a hard time. So bison tend to help create that balance, whereas cattle, there again, they were brought in by Europeans along with the various diseases, animal diseases that were brought in. So, you know, it really impacted the way nature is in this whole country. What's indigenous and what's not. We're indigenous people. Bison are indigenous. We're a lot alike. At one point in our history, we were both almost brought to near extinction. The prejudice that there is out there still today towards bison, there still is a lot of prejudice out there. And, you know, some of it comes from the cattle industry. We exist in a world right now that caters to one species of animal, and that's the domesticated cow. I mean, it's all over the world, you know, and they're wiping out rainforest to graze cattle on. People need to realize that there's more than one species of animal in this world, and it's certainly not cattle. And it's impacted everybody throughout the world. It's not just here in New Mexico or the United States, you know. I mean, it's impacting all of us.
The question is, how important is land to Native people? And I was born at Santa Clara Pueblo here in northern New Mexico, come from a large family of 10 brothers and sisters and a very, very strong extended family unit. And my father was a great farmer and a great hunter. In the wintertime, he spent much of his time in the mountains getting deer for his family. We would have easily common to the family that he would bring down 3 deer for the winter.
Dr. Tessie Naranjo from Santa Clara Pueblo and Dr. Sue Ellen Jacobs, co-directors of the Northern Pueblos Institute at Northern New Mexico College in Española, talk about Dr. Naranjo's relationship with the earth.
Then once he brought the deer down, it was up to my mother in particular, but then we would help my mother with the drying of the meat, the storing of the meat. That was what kept his large family surviving throughout the winter. Not only did he hunt, but he also was an expert fisher person. So, again, he would go up to Santa Clara Pueblo, up to the canyons, and fish and get trout. And so it was very common for us to have trout for breakfast, trout for lunch, trout for dinner, and have that with potatoes and anything else that my mother could find to complement the meat that was being served. I say all of this to say that living off the land when we were growing up, I was growing up in the early 40s, was how we kept our family together and fed. We lived seasonally, cyclically, meaning that my great-grandmother, who was alive at that time, she was born in the mid-1860s, she was the one who raised my mother, and then in turn, my mother then taught us what she knew from my great-grandmother. And so that living off of the land seasonally and knowing about the cycles of the seasons was something that was very common for us in our family unit. My great-grandmother was an herbalist, and so she needed help by the time we were 5, 6, 7 years old to go and gather the plants, seasonal plants, with her. It wasn't something that we especially looked forward to. It got us out. But as we were picking out the different plants with my mother, with my sisters, my brothers, and my great-grandmother, we began to start learning about the uses of these different plants. And we knew about the cycles of the seasons. As a result of that, in my older age now, I have a seasoned experience based on my experience as a child. So I love the idea of living off the land. I love the process that it takes to live off the land, what you have to do to carry yourself throughout the seasons. For example, there's this plant that we call hua in Tewa. In fact, right at this time, as I'm driving on the highway, I just look around, is it time for hua to be up? Because sure as anything, what I wanted to do, even if I don't need to, because I can go to Safeway, I want to go and pick hua. And what you do with hua, I imagine what my great-grandmother did, would pick as much hua, which is Rocky Mountain bee plant, pick as much of that as she could, because she had to cook it first. After she cooked it, she had to dry it and make pancakes out of it. And so these dried pancakes would then be preserved for the winter months so that we would have hua that was rehydrated when she needed to have that to feed her family. Land and what happens on the land is something that I have a lot of memories about. I love the fact that the land is to be looked at and that the Pueblo people modeled who they are by looking at the land. in our communities, our model is that feminine model, meaning we look at the land, and because it nourishes us in our social organization, in our religious activities.
My name is Jim Eno. I am the director of the Ashwi Awan Museum and Heritage Center. Agriculture has always been a framework for our religion.
I don't want to call it an element. It's something other than element. The land is something that is our model. It nourishes us.
Of course.
And so in that reciprocal relationship that we have with the land,
I suppose you could say,
it is about
a culture of survival.
Respecting
and agriculture has just always been a part of our lives and our culture way before Europeans came.
It is about a commitment to all that the land is and all that it offers us, because of that reciprocity that my mother, my father, my great-grandmother, and her mother, and her mother before them, all of them.
Botany's, it's always been a part of the Navajo teachings for, I think, for well over 500-600 years.
Arnold Clifford is a Diné botanist and geologist near Shiprock, New Mexico, on the Navajo Reservation. He shows the fine connection between land and culture.
Before there was a beginning of agriculture, we didn't have no plants that we were using as domesticated plants in terms of something that we would plant like corn and melons, squash, potatoes, alfalfa, beans. And we used to make our living off the land, have the land sustain us and provide whatever sustenance that we needed. We'll have like grains from a lot of these wild grasses that we have here. Gieta grass, and there's things like sand drop grass and drop seeds, and there's also what they call Indian rice grass. And a lot of our foods came from natural settings. A lot of these wild berries too, they took time to prepare, and there's a special way to prepare some of these shrubs that produce berries. And then also some of these are herbaceous forbs. They produce these pods or fruits, and some are not really tasty from the beginning, but there's a special way to actually prepare some of these, and these were some of the actual dishes that were made from the land before there was even agriculture. It was something I've always known about and I've always learned. Like, my first ecology instructors were actually my grandparents and my uncles and my elders, because when they used to tell me to look for specific plants, you know, I used to, they'll describe these specific sites. It grows in a gravelly area under pinyon juniper trees. They'll grow on sandstone ledges. They'll store in these like fractures of these sandstones. So when they're looking for specific plants, they would describe these habitats in detail, and they would also describe the areas that they were most likely to be found or where they were found before. So that was the way I learned about botany. It's like, I call it native science, Navajo science. So it's like Navajo botany, Navajo ecology, Navajo geology. With the Navajo language, our language is actually scientifically based, scientific and mathematically based, because we have our own teachings of botany. We consider certain people are designated as botanists, and then certain people are designated as people who study rocks. You know, those would be like our Navajo geologists or whatever. Mm-hmm. Because in the past, it was important to study rocks, because sometimes, take for example, table salt, it's all common these days. We take it for granted. You know, people just keep using it every meal, and you know, that's why we get diabetes and stuff like that, high blood pressure. But in the past, table salt was scarce. It was very, very, very difficult to find. There's only like two or three known locations reservation-wide. These natural settings where these table salts were hacked out of, where they were taken out of, when people harvest them, they didn't take the whole thing. They'll just take like small chunks, and then they'll pulverize this, and then they'll share this among each other. It was a very sacred substance that they considered a sacred object. And they used to reserve it like for very special times and for ceremonial purposes. So it was readily available, and they had to have somebody study rocks in order to figure out where these salt deposits occurred at, you know, to inform the tribal members that were looking for table salt. And then also another one that we often use is kaolinite. There's a mineral in kaolinite. We call it tlesh in Navajo. That's one that we use like for like stomach aches, and also like to whiten things, like whiten wool. And you also had to know the specific areas where these kaolinite formed as well. People used to study layers of rocks just to figure out where they would occur at. And these were also considered really very sacred sites where people used to do pilgrimages, and they make offerings and when they go to these sites in order to obtain these minerals and elements. Just based on that, I think Navajo languages, Navajo teachings and cultures really, really scientifically based.
He explains a sheep economy.
Sheep was considered like stored wealth. wealth that's being regenerated all the time. You got monetary value for selling like your lambs. That'll be like every spring or like the fall, depending on when you lamb. Then also you get money for bartering power or trading power with your wool, like the wool that you shear. The price of wool has really gone down, so that's kind of like a detrimental for people doing their shearing now. So a lot of people, they end up just discarding their wool instead of reselling them.
You're listening to The Shift of Land, where we explore the connection between land and culture and agriculture in New Mexico. This is Jim Enote from the Zuni Pueblo.
My name is Jim Enote. I am the director of the Oshawa-Awan Museum and Heritage Center. Agriculture has always been a framework for our religion, and it has always connected us to the earth and the climate, seeds, of course, seasons, moons, things like that. So we were always, I suppose you could say, a culture of survival. And agriculture has just always been a part of our lives and our culture, way before Europeans came.
Hi, my name is Louis Hina. I'm from Tisuki Pueblo.
Louis Hina is a part of the Native American Farmers Association. The traditional people of these lands had worked with the land to develop their very complex and effective ways to deal with the climate in order to grow food to sustain their culture.
Well, the people relied upon integrated systems of diverse technologies to harvest and conserve water for crop production. And the people manipulated all four principles of moisture resources available, such as direct precipitation, intermittent runoff, groundwater, and permanently flowing river, spring, and seep waters. One of the best known field technologies visible in the Rio Grande are the gravel mulch plots, densely covered low mesas and terrace escarpments overlooking well-watered alluvial bottomlands, such as behind me here. Typically raised above their surrounding ground surface, gravel mulch plots usually depend entirely upon direct snowfall and rainfall for their moisture. Because their massive stone construction renders them less permeable to runoff, some fields placed at slope bases work to trap and redirect runoff to nearby terraces, pits, or other planting areas.
Gravel mulch plots depended on what the environment gave. The people used the sand as mulch and stones to heat the ground and plants. They had ditches and terraces. Hina explained that the people used the land as a sponge. Again, Arnold Clifford.
Well, now we think about land on a daily basis. We think, and me, I think about plants and stuff like that on a daily basis. Like with plants, you know, we consider them plant people. They're dynamic, they're on the move, and they're, you know, you talk to them and stuff like that. Like we see it in our artwork, see it in our sand paintings. Even this, the teachings, the Navajo teachings, it's all from the land. Man, women were developed from corn. Like man was developed from white corn, women was developed from yellow corn. And that's how our creation story starts off, you know, we're from the dirt, you know, from the ground.
The land gives us our cultures. A silent clash or crash of cultures has continued since the Spanish, but especially the U.S. took this area from Mexico in 1848. The industrialized model and the reservation system shifted cultures. I asked Professor Naranjo and Professor Jacobs when things began to change as far as farming in the Pueblo communities.
Well, my response to that, Sue Ellen, is when you and I were teaching the course Native American Literature this past semester, and my brother Tito was a guest speaker in the class, and he presented to the class members a paper that he had written a couple of years ago. It was called A Cultural Bomb. And the paper had to do with the effects of Los Alamos on the communities down here in the Rio Grande Valley. And so as people were finding work, it was no longer a bartering situation. It was a beginning of money for labor, so that you had an increasing number of people from the valley, Spanish-speaking and Tewa-speaking people, traveling back and forth to Los Alamos. Not as much as now, but it was beginning. And my father was one of those individuals, and members from your adopted family at San Juan Pueblo were also going back and forth by the day. So life in the communities as we know it began to change. And Tito said it so well in his paper, Cultural Bomb, about how life changed when men began to start going to Los Alamos to go to work.
So that the extraction of men from the community was first through the military's development of this horrific bomb, and then the next thing is they began to extract the men to go to war. So we have that period, too, when the men are not available to continue attending to the fields and taking care of the ditches and so on. And in San Juan, the most important thing that the women did who stayed behind, I mean, of course, most women stayed behind, was to have kitchen gardens, which was being encouraged everywhere. And that was another impact in terms of that wage labor economy that people so quickly became accustomed to.
I asked what changed.
Men forgot how to farm.
Men weren't at home. If for those men who had a job in Los Alamos, they were gone most of the day. They would come in the evening only to go back up to Los Alamos. So they were separated from their community, not only their community, but their families. And so life changed considerably. We begin to start thinking of ourselves not in an extended family way, but in terms of that nuclear family situation. And so that was a big, big shift for us, to the point now where we are as familiar in the Pueblo communities with the idea of a nuclear family. And sure, there is a real conscious valuing of the extended family, but not to the extent that it was before Los Alamos came to be. I remember when I was a little kid, Sue Ellen, in the early 40s, where I would remember the moments when we had these huge gatherings at my great-grandmother's house for particular times. And we would all gather, and food was the one thing that was all that always brought us together. But if you've got wage labor, then not everybody can come and participate at a moment's notice. So things definitely change within the community. It was all about work. It was all about being able to have enough money to go to the store and get those extra things that you needed, going to the store to get the clothing that the children needed. More and more and more of that was happening. Lots of changes in the community. The kinds of foods that we were eating, I still think about feast days. We have stews as a big part of our feast foods, but also other things came into being, like potato salad is a big feast fare in the Pueblos for their big feast events. Jell-O is a big, big thing, along with the chico soup, the chili, the beans, the garbanzos, all of those things. So we were introduced to these different foods as a result of the wage economy, you know?
A lot of the women didn't actually work in the lab. A lot of the women worked in the homes of the scientists who were making the bomb. And the men were doing various chores in the lab itself and outside of the lab on the peripheries. What women brought back was an understanding of the way the scientists and their wives lived and the kinds of material goods that they had and how easy it seemed to be to get those things. And you know, as I understand it, women everywhere want to lighten their load when you've got children and you have to cook for everybody and all of that. So if you can shave off a half hour of the day by not having to do the preparation from scratch, as it used to be you had to get pozole, if you can buy it in a can that somebody else has done all that hard work for you, that helps a lot.
My pet word, process.
Yeah.
Is compromised again and again and again. Canned foods,
yeah.
You no longer have to do the corn from scratch.
That's right. So you have that, not only that system of barter, but the obligations, the reciprocity that happens because you help somebody else during their time of need and they help you. So it does more of that fracturing of the extended family into small groups and who can make the most money and who's got the most stuff. begins to appear on the horizon. This is happening all over the country, by the way. It's not just in the pueblos that it's going on, but the whole country is just forgetting the origins of the human community.
And the relationship to the land?
Yes.
And to our opa, the universe? We're losing that?
Well, agriculture is important to us because...
Again, Jim Enot.
It's the basis of our survival here. We have always been able to grow our own crops or grow our own food. And we may think of development as creating more jobs and opportunities, and I can see that, and I can understand how that can be considered development. But I think if we consider a longer time scale, that markets may change, that we may make a good fortune in 10 years or 20, 50, or 100 years, but in 100 years or 200 years, markets can shift. This part of the world may find itself very poor or lacking many things. Many things can happen. Many things I don't even want to think about, but things can really change in many drastic ways. But if we can still grow our own food, that to me is a development that needs to be promoted. Land and water, what I would consider agricultural lands, I think will eventually be the refuge of our people. I think someday agricultural lands will be the place that everyone will not only want to be, but will need to be.
I asked Danny Sam what it means to be New Mexican.
Well, yes, for me, that means being Native American also, because there's such a high population of Native Americans here in New Mexico. Along those lines, there's a lot of culture that's still intact within the different tribes here in New Mexico. So there's a big sense of devotion to community and the tribe and the people here. You know, in a lot of places in this country, we've seen people lose their cultures and really have no identity left other than they're Americans, and, you know, they don't really have an idea of where they come from or, you know, what their cultures are or their languages or any of that stuff. So I guess to me, you know, that being New Mexican is, you know, that's pretty much the way I would define it for myself and my family also.
The land and its own agriculture, whether cultivated or natural, has shaped the different peoples living in a hard but giving environment. Many pueblos have different dances, such as the corn dance or the buffalo dance, giving thanks for that which sustained them. Today, native New Mexicans, Nuevo Mexicanos, and tourists visit friends and families during different feast days. The land gave these practices and bounties, and it's honored and integrated through culture. This program was made possible through a grant from the New Mexico Humanities Council in association with the National Endowment for the Humanities, as well as through a grant from the Albuquerque Community Foundation. We would like to thank Jack Rabbit for mailing support, Kit Carson Telecom for internet support, Venado Partners for web design, KRZA Radio, Dusty Yellow Thunder associate producer, and all individuals who gave their time to be interviewed. Theme music was composed and performed by Fidel Gonzalez from El Caballero Aguila Recording Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico. You can hear full interviews and find more information about these issues at www.theshiftofland.org. I'm Sarah Parker. Thank you for listening.